second. Good morning, everybody. I don't know why I'm waiting. I don't know what I'm waiting for. But maybe like you all, we have a family DJ that when I'm in the car with our family DJ, which at this time is my youngest son, he's responsible for playing all of our music. So so recently, we have been overdosing on 21 Pilots. And that, I'm sure some of you have heard of that band, and it is a main staple in our family playlist these days. But only true fans of 21 Pilots know about Clancy and Trench. Only true fans know about Clancy and Trench that appears in their song lyrics and is being highlighted in their most recent singles that are coming out. Their lyrics are loaded with narrative and symbolism. And Clancy and Trench are part of a larger storyline that the band has been developing. And in the recent singles that have been released, this narrative gets expanded. Clancy represents a character that's struggling with inner conflicts and doubts and challenges. And Trench, of course, you already know, I'm sure, is depicted as a metaphorical place, a state of mind, so to speak. You already knew that, right? I could tell. And this is actually the place where these struggles that Clancy is having is taking place. State of mind, or a kind of a metaphorical place that's being depicted. So overall, Clancy and Trench symbolize the themes in their music of introspection, self-reflection, battling some personal demons, striving for self-discovery and growing and maturing, growing up in the culture, all of which are central themes in 21 Pilots' music. And also essential themes in their storytelling. So every time I hear 21 Pilots, do you know what is beginning to draw me in deeper? Listening for Clancy and listening for Trench. So I'm starting to think and lean and try to interpret or try to hear, did I just hear a reference to Clancy having these battles? Are we now talking about what is happening in Trench, a metaphorical place of struggle and what have you? And I got to tell you that the Tyler, who is essentially 21 Pilots, has effectively hooked a 53-year-old grown man into his music, into their music. Only because now, well, essentially it starts with this: I care about what my son cares about, I care about the music he cares about, but I'm also becoming someone who wants to learn more about this place and this person, the lyrics, this band, and I'm someone who wants to understand. Now, those who don't care to understand and those who don't really want to learn more, I'm sure those references, probably even to some of you listening, are a bit confusing, or you just generally think it's easiest and safest to ignore it, and some who are listening are just dismissing the storyline altogether. They're listening to the music. They don't have a lot of interest in what the lyrics are saying. That's okay. That's fair enough. But lyrically, 21 Pilots, Tyler, who's the main songwriter, I think, if not, I'll get a harsh correction in the car on the way home. But he's writing these lyrics, and he's using a tool. And the tool that he's using is parable. It's a metaphor that is used. And remember, by the way, and how many of you have heard of this acronym here? Raise your hand if you've heard of this acronym. It's okay if you haven't. IYKYK. Yon tried that last week, completely butchered it. I want you to know I just aced it. Absolutely aced it. If you know, you know. So we'll talk together through Jesus' parables, and we're going to encounter rich, compelling truths that Jesus shares about the kingdom of God. And they have literally within them, within these short stories, these short metaphors, there is the power to shape how you think and how you live. If you care about those things, if you have an interest in Jesus' teaching and the authority and the reliability of his teaching. So what should we know or what should we remember about the parables? It helps to see a video and have it explained, but here's a little reminder and refresher for you. A parable is a common tool for teaching kingdom truths. It's a common tool that teaches kingdom truths. Now, I referenced 21 Pilots. It's a tool being used to teach the truths of Trench, right? In this case, this tool that's used for teaching kingdom truths comes through short stories with metaphor and with imagery. So using metaphor and imagery in these short stories, Jesus is trying to plant an understanding of what his kingdom is like and how his kingdom is different and how his kingdom is breaking into our kingdom. And when Jesus told these parables, people were often, it's actually recorded by the gospel writers, that people who heard it, it doesn't necessarily say every time people were amazed at his teaching. Do you know what it says in the gospels? People were so confused when he got done. The gospel writers tell us that people were often puzzled. Now, when I think of Jesus' teaching, I think of Jesus teaching and everybody's like, oh, that just cut to the heart. He just slayed me. Did you hear that? Oh, of course I heard that. I'm already feeling the heaviness and I'm falling on my face in conviction. And this is so alive to me that my heart is coming alive. Now, sometimes that happens, but I have to remind myself when Jesus is teaching these kingdom truths, oftentimes that's not what was happening. Men, women, and young people were often puzzled and confused. And even though most of Jesus' parables address situations that were very familiar with ancient listeners, using very common everyday items and experiences that would identify with the people that he's teaching to. Even though he would talk about seeds to farmers and fish to fishermen and birds and flowers to people who are very familiar with and devoted to the things they're experiencing in the land and in the sky. But by connecting familiar situations, Jesus is introducing new and different concepts of his own kingdom, and he's planting them in the mind of listeners. As always, we should be careful. And we're careful when we're listening to Jesus' teaching. And I want to make sure that we start with warning. When you're reading or listening to the parables, this is so important. When you're interpreting them as Jesus' short stories, we have to be very careful that we avoid some mistakes because they can cause some problems. If we see them as moralistic lessons, they can cause some problems. But essentially, we should be careful not to focus on exploring these stories for doctrine. Jesus is not using parables to teach lifelong orthodox doctrine that all of us should implement. He is illustrating something that he's telling a story that means something at that moment, right? And also, we should be careful not to sift the parables for one-liner life lessons on how to be successful. In other words, these parables are for you, but they're not about you. When you're reading the parables, they're for you, but they're not about you. You and I are not the center of the parable. At the center of the parable is Jesus arriving into the norms of our life and saying, you know how your normal kingdom goes? This is how mine is. And he just, bam, just inserts it right in there and says, mine is different. Mine is alive. Mine's upside down. Mine changes everything. My kingdom now is emerging and has arrived. My kingdom has come, and it's my will that things be done on earth the way that they're done in heaven. And then he starts to illustrate what that would look like and help us envision a new kingdom of believers who are devoted to following Jesus. His new kingdom being explained to us so that we can see it and know it. His new way of seeing the world. And in using this tool called parables, Jesus is concerned with using the power of imagery and symbolism and metaphor and beauty. And we should too, as we appreciate the parables. and appreciate the way that Jesus teaches. So his message, much like Isaiah's in the Old Testament, his message had paradoxical effect on listeners. Paradoxical effect. So here's what we see. That the parables, when they are told, when he's telling one of these stories, it reveals instruction for those with faith. So if you're listening to his story and you have faith, you're hearing instruction. You're learning something. You're seeing something different. But if you're hearing Jesus tell these stories without faith, it's confusing. And I think of it this way. It's somebody who, if you are listening to 21 Pilots and you don't have a teenage son who is highly invested in their music, then you don't care about Clancy and Trench. Do you? You don't, do you? You can be honest. You don't. You don't care about that. And when we get to that part of the song or that part of the album, are there albums anymore? Do we say album? Thank you. I will. When you get to that part of the cassette, and I mean 8-track, I don't mean, you know, whatever that other thing was, that new thing that came out. You know what I listened to? You know what I used to listen to on 8-track? Forgive me for this. I still remember sitting in my dad's car. I cannot remember which car it was, but I remember I was probably about 11 years old, and I would go into his car, ask for his key. I'm not sure he knew what I was doing, but I would turn his key to where you could use the accessory radio, and I took the 8-track cassette, Kenny Rogers, and would put it in the cassette player and listen to Gambler over and over and over again, and felt like I was sneaking it. That's literally the worst thing I've ever done as a kid. Kenny Rogers. So, do you know that when I hear The Gambler, do you know where I go? Back to this smelly, oily, greasy car in my dad's, listening on my dad's 8-track. Anyway, if you are listening to this band, 21 Pilots, you don't really have an interest, there's not anything drawing you to them, when you get to those parts, you don't care. This is what Jesus was doing. He was teaching in such a way as that those had some faith, those who had an interest, those who were like warming up in their heart to who Jesus was, they'd lean in and say, I want to understand this. This is actually drawing me in to better understand. And there's so many examples I could use. Some of the TV shows you watch, the movies that you watch, the books that you read. When something is referenced to Lord of the Rings or Chronicles of Narnia or any of the other series and you hear it, you're cracking the code if you want to and desire it and you are diving in to better understand the context. This is what Jesus is doing. He's putting it out there, and people with faith were instructed and people without faith were confused and puzzled, sometimes irritated. They would dismiss it, put it off, or otherwise just say, meh, I don't get it. I don't know what he's talking about. But if you had faith, Jesus is drawing you in. Come on, there's more. I'm just scratching the surface. I'm just illustrating more. Come on, come with me and learn and let these seeds go deep in your heart. It's going to bear fruit. There's going to be a harvest coming of learning about my kingdom. And pretty soon you're going to be living in my kingdom as a part of my kingdom, expanding my kingdom. And it all comes through this tool that he's using, instruction or confusion. Have you ever wondered why there are families with siblings, and maybe this is you, maybe this is you and your sibling, maybe this is in your own home, this is your own kids, or maybe the way your parents, who are brought up in the same home, hear the same teaching about Jesus, and somebody goes all in to receive and trust Jesus, and somebody else is just like, I have no interest. You ever wonder that? You ever wonder why in the same home, the same messaging, somehow their hearts are being instructed and others, their hearts are just being confused? Because there is something about a heart of faith that's willing to receive and one that doesn't, that is not. And essentially, we see that the person with faith will get these cryptic metaphorical stories and it'll penetrate their heart. Meanwhile, someone else's heart is being hardened. Like, why is this guy teaching this confusing stuff? And you could just sense their heart is hardening a little bit. I don't get it. Why does he have to be so fancy? Why can't he just talk straight and plain? He's drawn the heart. And through this language art that he's using, he's drawing some in close, and they're starting to ask questions, and they want to learn more, and they want to see the beauty of the way he was communicating. And one familiar way to think of this is that if you share an experience with Jesus, in any way you share the experience or you understand the context, it's kind of a if-you-know-you-know experience. If-you-know-you-know implies that you shared something with the person who just said it, right? It implies that something is understood or something is appreciated only by those who are familiar with the experience or the context. And so this whole series on the parables is basically Jesus saying, if you know, you know. If you care and share these experiences with me and you want to participate in my kingdom, then I'm going to be teaching in parables, and if you know, you know. And if you don't, you're going to continue to be confused and frustrated on the outside. If you shared an experience with someone who says, if you know, you know, you get it, right? And if not, you're dismissive and short and possibly irritated. So Jesus, this is a way for Jesus to connect with sincere believers and say to them, if you know, you know. He doesn't want to just simply tell his audience something and let it end there. He wants to draw them in. He wants to be known. He wants to be known for what he's like. He wants to be known for what he's doing and how he thinks and why he's doing it and why his kingdom is happening that way. So let's experience one of Jesus' real parables. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to have dinner with him. So if you're relatively new to the Christian faith, a Pharisee would be a religious teacher, someone who is a place of power and authority teaching the rules and regulations of Judaism, the law of God. How are you supposed to perform in order to please God? And this person here would be in charge of that, okay? So they asked Jesus, have dinner with me. So Jesus went to his home and he sat down to eat. When a certain immoral woman from that city heard he was eating there, she brought a beautiful alabaster jar filled with expensive perfume. Then she knelt behind him at his feet, weeping. Her tears fell on his feet, and she wiped them off with her hair. Then she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet. Now, don't forget, he said to himself, right? He's just thinking this. If this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of woman is touching him. Ew. That's what he's thinking. Ew. Jesus clearly is a regular old nobody if he doesn't know who's touching him. He would know what kind of woman is touching him. She's a sinner. Right? And so we see here, really quick, we see the Pharisee doing some comparisons in their identity. And what does he say? He says, first he compares himself to Jesus. He says, I'm very discerning, almost prophet-like, because I already know who this woman is compared to me. And by the way, Jesus isn't very discerning like I am. So he compares himself to Jesus, and then he compares himself to the woman, and he says, she's immoral, a sinner, and who is he? Holy, righteous, devoted. I mean, after all, he's got the most popular teacher in town who's come to dinner. Hope everybody notices who I am and who's come to dinner with me, and he's comparing himself to her and comparing himself to Jesus. So then Jesus answered his thoughts. This must make people crazy in the ancient world. This must make people crazy who are following Jesus. By the way, can you imagine discovering that Jesus can read your thoughts? Then he brings it up publicly. How many people were like, okay, I think I'm out here. I don't think I'm going to play this. I'm not going to risk this. I'm out of here. Jesus answers his thoughts. Simon, I love this. He said to the Pharisee, I have something to say to you. I mean, I don't know what this means, but Jesus tees this up. He sets this up. Hey, I know what you're thinking. You're comparing yourself to me. You don't think I'm that impressive of a prophet or even a prophet at all. And you're certainly not impressed with her, who you are describing as an immoral woman, maybe a prostitute. But I have something to say to you, Simon, because I know what you're thinking. Here we go. Here we go. Go ahead, teacher, Simon replied, and I imagine that he thought Jesus was going to say, I'm going to help you usher this immoral woman out of here because this is quite the scene. And you shouldn't be stained by her presence. Your reputation shouldn't be damaged by her being here. And this whole scene that she's doing with her perfume, she's wasting so much of what she could be donating to the temple. Can you imagine him thinking that? This is going to be a good one. I hope everybody's listening. Jesus has something to tell me, everybody. Come on in. Come on in. Hold on a second, Jesus. Let them, they're standing in the outside of my house. Would you have them come on in here? Because this is going to be good for me. And Jesus does this. Then Jesus tells him a story. Here we go. Here it comes. Here comes the parable. A man loaned money to two people. 500 pieces of silver to one, and 50 pieces to the other. But neither of them could repay it, so he kindly forgave them both, canceling their debts. Who do you suppose loved him more after that? Simon answered, well, I suppose the one for whom he canceled the larger debt. That's right, Jesus said. Now, Jesus is going to do a little comparing and contrasting of his own. He's going to do a little comparing and contrasting of this Pharisee, Simon, who's invited him in, and the immoral woman who shows up and turns over her expensive perfume and wipes his feet with her hair and tears. Then he turned to the woman and he said to Simon, look at this woman kneeling here. Now, this isn't the parable anymore. This is him in, it's getting recorded what he's saying and doing. Look at this woman kneeling here. When I entered your home, you didn't offer me water to wash the dust from my feet, a customary sign of decency, a customary sign of hospitality. You're welcome here in my home, signifying you're welcome here in my heart. You didn't do that. You didn't welcome me in. You had me to your home, but you didn't really welcome me in. You didn't offer me water to wash the dust from my feet. But she has washed them with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You didn't greet me with a kiss, but from the time I first came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You neglected the courtesy of olive oil to anoint my head, but she has anointed my feet with rare meaning expensive perfume. And this is important. Jesus contrasts their awareness of their need for him. He contrasts their awareness of their desperation for Jesus. He puts side by side a vivid, painful contrast of the Pharisees' clear self-reliance compared to her full dependence on Jesus. Their awareness is being contrasted. The religious rule keepers basically are saying, since I'm faithfully following God's rules, I owe Jesus nothing. Since I'm faithfully following the rules, I don't even owe him a little olive oil for his head. I don't owe him a little water for his feet. I don't even owe him warmth and hospitality in my own home. Why? Because before God, I am performing, I am following the rules, and I am approved and accepted before God. So I don't need this guy. He's not even a prophet. If he was, he'd have known what kind of scene was being caused here. The immoral woman, she's saying, I owe Jesus my life. She's saying, without him, I am getting the sense that I'm condemned, not just culturally, not just relationally, not just condemned morally, but I'm condemned to die separate from God. And I am desperate for Jesus because without him, I'm in trouble. And what's the sign that she feels that way? Well, making expensive sacrifice of her outer beauty. By the way, that perfume would enhance her outer beauty. But what is she doing? She's throwing away. She's crashing open this bottle representing the enhancement of her outer beauty in order to get close to Jesus with the hope that he's going to lift the shame from her inner ugliness and she's now going to be free and experience a healing on the inside and this beauty of having Jesus lift her shame from the inside. And in her mind, paying the price of spilling perfume and tears on his feet and lowering herself to adore and to worship Jesus is not a sacrifice. It's worship. It's a joy. It is a natural, normal reaction to what she's aware that Jesus is doing and is preparing to do. So look what Jesus points out. Look what Jesus points out. He points out that you're saved by your faith, he says to the woman, and by my forgiveness. Check this out. I tell you, her sins, and they are many, have been forgiven. So she has shown me much love. But a person who is forgiven little shows only little love. Now, your much love for Jesus here is driven by your much need for Jesus. Your much love is driven by your much need, is what Jesus is teaching. In other words, an awareness of your much forgiveness generates and drives your love for Jesus. There's an awareness factor of your need for Jesus that drives your affection for Jesus. Does that make sense? So, then Jesus said to the woman, your sins are forgiven. Your sins are forgiven. Now, what is the response from the Pharisee and the religious people that have gathered in the house? Can you imagine the response? They say, thank God. She has needed her sins forgiven for so long, and we're so glad that's finally happening. Somebody finally expressed that to her. Maybe they say, wow, this is a very fortunate plot twist for us here. Do they say, oh, we knew it. We knew that our God is so merciful. And here's another example of his mercy. Instead, you know what they say? Who does this guy think he is? Who is this? Look at this. The men at the table said among themselves, who is this man that he goes around forgiving sins? And Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. They're not saved, by the way, by her commitment. She's not saved by her commitment to change. She isn't expressing to Jesus, I'm going to live better. I'm going to turn over a new leaf. I'm starting a new chapter today. Now that I met Jesus, it's a new chapter. I'm starting over today. In this parable, like all other parables, here's what we're seeing. Jesus announces and he describes the arrival of his new kingdom. He's announcing his new kingdom and he's describing things are changing, things are different. My kingdom is not the same as your kingdom. And Jesus is referring to himself here, announcing that in my kingdom there's four spiritual truths, at least. In this story and in this parable, there's four spiritual truths that desperately need your attention if you're going to understand me and you're going to understand my kingdom. Here's the first one. My forgiveness, Jesus says, is radical. My forgiveness is radical. It is, I don't know, I can't think of a different word to say. It is shocking, surprising, stunning. My forgiveness has a radical nature that I'm depicting in this parable. Forgiveness, by the way, is offered by the creditor in the parable. Remember the parable? One's got $500 debt. One's got, for the sake of translating for us, $500 debt. Another one's got a $50 debt. And forgiveness here is offered to both creditors. So that's important. But it's not based on their merit. It isn't based on which one deserves it. Someone worked harder. Instead, it's freely given to both of them out of grace. A willingness, God's own mercy. And by the way, grace means unmerited favor. It's favor that you're receiving that hasn't been earned or deserved. It's to receive something that you're not entitled to. And what we're learning here is that Jesus is offering a forgiveness that is different from the kind of forgiveness that we offer. When we offer forgiveness in our kingdom, we look for ways in which someone deserves it. Are they trying to get their life together? Did they really mean it? Are they making progress in their life? Are they doing things different now than they did before, and then I can kind of unleash this forgiveness? Ours is all based on their performance, typically. Jesus is saying, my forgiveness and grace is based on my own character. It's based on my mercy. Secondly, he's pointing out this. Human sinfulness is unexpectedly deep. Human sinfulness is unexpectedly deep. The significance here is important of the debts that are owed by the two debtors. One larger debt, this is important. The larger debt represents a greater awareness of sin and the need for forgiveness. The greater debt should represent more alertness to how much Jesus has forgiven them for. And the smaller debt represents a lesser awareness. Maybe who someone feels like sin is just kind of like making mistakes, my imperfections. Hey, nobody's perfect, right? We all sin. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. In fact, I've come across people who, when they refer to sin, they say, I'm not a murderer. I haven't killed anybody. In other words, I haven't done the worst thing you could possibly do in human history. I've never done that. So when you're talking about sin or sinners, I wouldn't be in that category. But Jesus is not teaching that some of us are $500 sinners and some of us are $50 sinners. And we have to be careful that we don't read this way. Jesus is not saying, hey, some of you owe me a lot. Some of you, not so much. A lot versus a little. It's not what he's saying. But instead, they represent the level of awareness, the depth of awareness. The New Testament describes human sinfulness in a doctrine called total depravity. The New Testament talks about human heart being rotten to the core. That called a sinful nature. That's basically the pervasive nature of sin affects every aspect of human beings. Every aspect. Our thoughts, desires, emotions, actions, and relationships. Also, this doctrine teaches that we are dead and helpless except for God's intervention. In other words, that humans have an inability to save themselves or to earn their salvation through their own effort and performance. That apart from divine grace, that we as human beings are essentially dead to God. That we are enemies and dead, asleep and blind to God. That's the part of the description of the human condition apart from God's intervention, unable to initiate any genuine seeking after God. And also, this doctrine helps us understand the human condition as corrupt, a radical corruption of our nature, which is due to the fall. We remember where it happened. That there's a fundamental distortion of our affections and our will, right at the fundamental core of who we are and what we do. And it affects our ability to choose God or to respond positively to God or to respond in any way to spiritual truths without the enabling work of the Holy Spirit. Now, this parable, both debtors, the moral and the immoral, are sinful. You got that? So here's something that helps us understand what we're experiencing together. Now, you don't have to do this, but if you looked around at our church family who's gathered here today, if you looked around, you don't have to do that. In fact, please don't, right? Introverts, so I got you. Don't look at me. But if you did, do you know what you would not see? You would not see that you're looking at some of the folks in our church family are $50 sinners. Even though sometimes you feel like a $500 sinner. And there are sometimes where we feel like a $50 sinner because of who we know and who we're near and who we've talked to, and we start to make these categories in our mind that that's probably like a $500 sinner. I mean, compared to them, I'm like a $50 folk. Jesus isn't doing that. Jesus is saying, 50, 500, 5,000, 5 million, an infinite amount of sinning. It's the same. It's the same. You are dead, corrupt, and radically incapable of responding to me apart from the Holy Spirit's intervention to say, here comes life to your heart. Here comes life to your faith. And we have to grasp this. And if we don't grasp this, this is what happens to our church family. If we don't grasp this, we Christians start to spend time with each other believing that we're a little bit more acceptable to God than someone else. And we don't say things like that. We don't tell ourselves those things, but we start to act out that way. I am going to pat myself on the back because I'm sure that God's noticed that I don't act like that. I am not that selfish, rebellious, disobedient, mixed up, chaotic, and confused. And I want you to know, church family, you're among a whole gathering, without exception, of people who are million-dollar sinners. No comparison. And the bottom line is this, when we approach Jesus like we're going to at our communion remembrance at the end of our service, when we approach Jesus, we approach him at the same level. Essentially, desperately, each one of us desperately approaching God and in a metaphorical way ought to be spilling out everything that we have that's of value, everything that we have that we think makes us outwardly beautiful, every one of our time, bits of our time, talent, and treasure, all of ourselves to the point where we're responding with tears and using what we have, hair, clothing, or whatever, to wipe Jesus' feet in a way of expressing worship. Thankfulness. But you know when we don't do that? When we don't really, aren't really convinced that we need all that forgiveness. We maybe need a little. Maybe a dash, maybe a wink, maybe a salute from Jesus, maybe a little, I don't know what you're into, whatever it is. But you know what we need, each of us? The wages of sin is death. That's the payment. The wages of sin is death. For who? The immoral woman? No, for every one of us. Level playing field. When we approach Jesus, the ground is the same. When we're serving Jesus, the ground is the same. When we're adoring, worshiping, praying, following, serving Jesus among the church family, the level's the same. And I think that that helps us care for each other, serve each other, love each other with the kind of love that happens in God's kingdom. Not categorized or divided by whether or not we think we're a $50 sinner. So Jesus is saying, beware of this. In my kingdom, religious rule followers and prostitutes share the same level of sinfulness in my kingdom. And I got to tell you, that's a radical idea. That sinfulness is unexpectedly deep. Also, the human response to Jesus reveals understanding. You remember that story, reference I just made recently where I said, have you ever come across people who brought up in the same home? Maybe they've had the same teaching, literally the same, from the same person, same people, what have you, completely different responses? A lot of what's happening there is one person has clarity on their understanding and the other one doesn't. A lot of what's happening there is that the Holy Spirit has opened the eyes to fully or better understand more fully what's been given, who Jesus is, and there's kind of an excessive gratitude and love that flows from experiencing Jesus' excessive forgiveness. There's an excessive gratitude that flows from experiencing Jesus' excessive forgiveness. Now, this immoral woman, by the way, often identified as Mary Magdalene, expresses deep gratitude and love for Jesus because she understands the extent of her sinfulness. She grasps it. And I got to say that I find myself more energized by people like her who are aware of their need for Jesus than someone who isn't. She's obviously aware that this her own sin is going to cost Jesus a lot. And that Jesus' cost of forgiveness, his cost to forgive, is far surpasses her cost for the perfume. This expensive perfume is only a relatively small sacrifice. It's a relatively small sign of her great awareness of her sinfulness and Jesus' forgiveness. So she has a new understanding that causes something. And I want you to think about this, if you would, real quick. Our increasing awareness leads to our excessive affection. The more aware we are of our desperation for Jesus, I believe that there is something flows out of that, and that is more affection. To the degree in which we know our need, to the degree in which we're aware of our desperation for Jesus, is the degree in which our affection will be growing for Jesus. In other words, if we don't need him, we won't want him. If we don't need him, we won't love him. But if we are self-reliant, and independent will have very little affection for Jesus. So, last truth. Lastly, a personal encounter with Jesus leads to transformation. This is what Jesus is teaching in the parable. He's teaching that that there's a broader theme breaking in through God's kingdom, which is a theme of transformation and redemption. And that when you encounter Jesus, you can experience his forgiveness, which leads to a life that's characterized by excessive affection and joy and gratitude and humility. An outward gratitude, a new desire to live in submission to God's will. Why would I desire to live in submission to God's will? Because I am aware. I have affection. I'm alert to what it cost him and how desperate I was for his death to take my place. So there's hope found in the redemptive work of Jesus. And this kingdom helps us to see that this kingdom teaching helps us to see that that transformation that we desire is coming through Jesus. Not just forgiveness, but also transformation. Not just being brought to God, but living with and for God, ruling and reigning as a part of his own kingdom. And we do that by the power of the Spirit that's gradually conforming us to his image. So, can I ask you to do something? Enjoy the beauty of the parables. Can I ask you not just to read them as if you are reading words on a page, but step back on occasion when you come to a parable and enjoy its beauty. Take it in. Imagine the meaning. Do more than listen and personalize. Imagine and feel and let your heart be challenged. Let your heart be provoked. And I hope that you see, I hope this is one of your takeaways. I hope that you step back and you say, I don't know who told me the Bible was bland. I don't know who told me the Bible was irrelevant. I don't know who told me the Bible was outdated. I don't know who told me the Bible wasn't going to engage the reader. As you step back and look at the beauty of the parables, it's my prayer. It would be my joy if you literally delighted in what you were seeing, in the metaphor, in the symbolism that you were looking at. Linger in those. Explore those. Dig a little deeper. Understand the meaning. Pursue the interpretation. Meditate on those truths. You had four of those truths today. Take it in. Let it nourish you. Learn and long for more of God's kingdom come now and more of God's kingdom come right here among us. Secondly, can I ask you to do this? I invite you to enhance your awareness to expand your affection for Jesus. Enhance your awareness. If you're ever wondering, I don't know why other people are more zealous for Jesus. I don't know why other people are more passionate. I'm wondering why I lack some freshness, some fire for Jesus. I don't know why other people seem to be a little bit more affectionate. I desire some more affection. It's possible that you tend to focus on the sins of other people and not your own. It's possible. It's possible that when we feel like that, we have just learned to diminish the severity of our own sin. Right? We make mistakes and we're imperfect. We make mistakes, we're imperfect. Other people, they do terrible things. Us, we make mistakes, we're imperfect. That's also possible. We diminish our own sin, selfishness, rebellion, pride of life, lust of the eyes and the flesh, telling God essentially by the way we live, leave me alone, I'm going to do my own thing. It's also possible that we don't have that kind of infection because we misinterpret the significance of Jesus' grace. And we trust and rely far more on our own holiness, righteousness, obedience, faithfulness, good intentions. And when that happens, I think this is what happened. Our hearts get harder and harder and harder as our need for Jesus diminishes. And I need to see and confess my own sin in order to enjoy and rejoice in his forgiveness. If you have ever taken time to go through our roots track that Pastor Yon referred to this morning, you will see, you'll come across what's called the cross chart. I think it's still called the cross chart. And essentially, it shows how spiritual maturity is not how long you have been a Christian. Spiritual maturity is an increasing, over time, awareness of God's holiness and also my sinfulness. And the distance, as time goes on, you start to see a greater gap between God's holiness and my sinfulness. And that means that as you age in your faith, you have greater need and dependence on the cross that needs to expand to cover that gap. And that if you don't need, if God isn't that holy and you're not that sinful, you only need a little cross. It's just a small gap. It's all you need, a little cross. But over time, as you mature in your faith, we believe this, that as your awareness grows, right? And that's a part of that's the bad news. The good news is what brings us joy. It's the rest of the story, not just that we deserve death, but the good news that it's already been paid for. So that expands our affection for Jesus. How you doing? Doing okay? You've got a symbol nearby. The communion elements are nearby. It's so appropriate that we take some time now to remember what it is that we're appreciating, what it is that we're experiencing that is provided to us only by Jesus. The wages of sin is death, but there's a gift, and the gift of God is life in Jesus. The gift of God is Jesus himself. And today, as you're working on getting those elements separated, we invite you to join us. If you trust Jesus, you don't have to belong to our church, but you need to belong to Jesus. How? By faith. You just trust Jesus. You've put your roots, your hope, joy, trust in the work of Jesus, not in your own. And if that's you, we invite you to join with us. If that's not you, we encourage you to wait until you have a greater understanding of what these symbols mean and why you would be receiving this communion. But today, if you're joining us, remember that what you're experiencing with Jesus here today is what draws us to spill our tears on Jesus' feet, to clean them with whatever we have, hair, clothing. It's a picture of our desperation for what he's done. Why? Because if he doesn't die, I die. If he doesn't live perfectly, that's my standard, perfection. But instead, what God demanded, he provided. What he requires of us by his grace, he provides to us and for us. We only get credit if we have faith in Jesus, because then we get Jesus's credit. Apart from Jesus, it's only blame. It's his suffer love that we enjoy together today. His love demonstrated by his suffering. Suffer love. The reason that we should spend all of our most precious perfume on him. In other words, our heart's worship, everything that God has given us, spent on him because of what he has paid that so far outweighs our own. You've got these elements in your hand. Remember, on the night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took some bread and gave thanks for it. Then he broke it in pieces and he said, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this to remember me." If you receive that element this morning as a symbol of his broken body. In the same way, he took the cup of wine after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant between God and his people, an agreement confirmed with my blood. Do this to remember me as often as you drink it. For every time you are eating this bread and drinking this cup, you are announcing the Lord's death until he comes again." Would you receive that second symbol, the cup? And church family, I invite you to stand together this morning. We have a prayer team that's coming down to meet you at the front of the auditorium here by the platform. And here's what I want to invite you to do. Here's what I'll invite you to do. I want to invite you to bring yourself to one of our church family members, and I want to invite you to join with them in prayer. And today, if you are have a desire. It's time. There's some kind of new affection that you need. You need a spark. You need a fire. You need a new joy. You need to kind of recapture the joy of your salvation. I want to invite you to slip out of your seats and make your way down and let somebody pray with you to believe that whatever it is you need, God is willing and able to provide it. New affection, new joy, new spark, new hope. But you're ready to receive because the truth of God's kingdom is stirring your heart. Would you slip out of your seat now and make your way down and join one of our family members who want to put their faith with your faith? And while we're singing, I also want to invite anyone who needs God's intervention. Your physical body needs a healing. Your relationship needs a healing. Marriage, family, kids need God's intervention, needs healing. When you step out of your seat and walk towards the front, here's what you're saying. I can't do this on my own. Only God can do this. Only God can do this. I can't do it on my own. I invite you to testify to that by letting us pray with you today. Let's sing and pray, pray and sing. Come on, join with me.